Hello and welcome to episode 23 of Africa Past and Present, the podcast about African history, culture, and politics. I'm your host, Peter Alleggi, flying solo this week since Peter Lim is in Malawi on an official visit, helping to develop the partnership between Michigan State University and the University of Malawi. My special guest on the show today is Dr. Paul Darby, senior lecturer in sport and exercise at the University of Ulster at Jordanstown in Northern Ireland, where I visited last week. Paul invited me to give a talk at a seminar series, and I spoke about the 2010 World Cup in South Africa and the opportunities and the challenges in hosting this global mega event for South Africa. Dr. Darby's research interests lie in the social sciences and the history of sport. He has published extensively on the role of Gaelic games in the lives of the Irish diaspora in North America. For instance, he just released with David Hassan an edited collection published by Routledge entitled Emigrant Players, Sport and the Irish Diaspora. But I first encountered Paul's research through his work on Africa and the politics of world football, which is the subject of a great book entitled Africa Football and FIFA, Politics, Colonialism, and Resistance, published in 2002 by Frank Cass in London. Paul has also published an edited collection with Martin Johns and Gavin Mellor on Soccer and Disaster, International Perspective, also from Routledge in 2005. And as you'll hear in the interview, which we did at the University of Ulster last week, he is currently working on an exciting project with Alan Klein, an anthropologist at Northeastern University in Boston, on globalization, the academy system, and the migration of football labor in Ghana and also baseball labor in the Dominican Republic. Here's our interview. Well, this week we are podcasting from the University of Ulster at Jordanstown. I'm here with Professor Paul Darby, an expert in the study of sport and society, particularly African sport and the sport of the Gaelic Athletic Association. And Paul, where did your motivation to study sport and society come from, and how does Africa fit into it?
Well, I suppose that my motivation for examining the relationship between sport and society really stemmed from being an undergraduate student here at the University of Ulster. My first degree was a generic degree on sport, exercise and leisure, but I had a particular interest in the social sciences of sport. I had a particular interest in the history and politics of the Gaelic Athletic Association. My interest also stemmed from the fact that I am a member of the Gaelic Athletic Association.
And also an athlete.
Well, I would use the term athlete very, very loosely, as you saw. In terms of the history of the Gaelic Athletic Association, I mean, this was an organisation that was established in 1884, specifically as a response to British imperialism in Ireland. So this organisation was founded predominantly as a form of resistance against the spread of British imperial culture, particularly British sports forms. Soccer, rugby, cricket, which gained a degree of popularity here in Ireland. So the Gaelic Athletic Association then revised a tradition, a lost tradition of Gaelic sports, and these sports came to form a key arena around which Irish nationalism was expressed. So really, on the back of an interest in those sorts of issues, I had the opportunity to pursue PhD level studies, and I was thinking about a range of projects when one of my professors spoke to me about an idea that he had based loosely on a book that he was writing on FIFA, and he wanted somebody to be involved in the data collection for particular elements of the project. And I started to read around the subject of sport in Africa, the role of sport in Africa, particularly Baker and Mangan's collection of essays.
Right.
And what that revealed to me was similarities in terms of the role and function of sport in African societies in comparison with the role of sport here on the island of Ireland. Similar themes began to emerge in terms of resistance against imperial pressures. So I was really sold on the idea of concentrating on the role of sport within the context of Africa, specifically the role of football. So that's really the background to my academic interest in the role of sport in African societies.
And this interest then blossomed into a wonderful doctoral dissertation and really the first book of its kind entitled Africa, FIFA and Football, published by Frank Cass in London 2002. And this is a book that every scholar who works on African football must read and frequently is cited, including the most recent FIFA publications that borrow heavily from your work and draw from its insights. Tell us a little bit about the major points in that work and what you discovered in looking at Africa's role in the politics of world football.
Well, I suppose that the broad research question that underpinned that study was to assess, as you say, Africa's place within FIFA's global order. And in order to get a sense of Africa's current place within FIFA politics, of course, I had to historically contextualise the role of the game in African societies. And that revealed to me a very rich and fascinating history. The game was arrived in Africa, of course, on the wings of the European Empire. It was used as a tool of cultural imperialism. But the interesting thing about the role, for me at least, the interesting thing about the role of soccer in African societies was that the game in a whole range of African colonies began to be Africanized, indigenized, and local people began to use the game as a vehicle for expressing a whole range of indigenous identities.
And this is very much what you see, of course, in other areas of colonial societies, right? I mean, if you look at the history of India or many other African colonies, right, you've got the civilizing missions, so-called civilizing missions of the Europeans, bringing also the tools that are used for resistance purposes.
Sure.
Think of Mahatma Gandhi, who, of course, was an attorney, came to the United Kingdom, then traveled to South Africa, was there for 20 years, and the language of universal rights, of human rights, right, was conceived of in its modern sense in the West, right, and it got used by colonized people to gain their freedom and to fight for their independence. So football, in a way, is deeply enmeshed in these larger changes, no?
Absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting paradox in terms of the role of football and the fact that initially it was used as a tool of cultural imperialism, but gradually went through that process of being Africanized and was used as a way of expressing resistance against a range of colonial powers. That process developed across a range of different time periods in a range of different colonies, but by, I suppose, about the early 1940s into the 1950s, the game in Africa was already quite politicised. And that politicisation of the game began to be reflected in terms of the relationship between independent African nations and FIFA. Because one of the points that I make in the book is that African nations, as soon as they acquired their independence, they joined organisations like the United Nations, but they also joined organisations that would give them a lot of international visibility. And of course, what better vehicle than football to do that? So
right.
they formed their own national federations. They sought membership of the Confederation of African Football. They sought membership of FIFA. And there was an expectancy that their emergence into the world of football would provide them opportunities to express their newfound independence and identities on the world stage. Unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Why not?
Well, it happened predominantly because up until that time period, FIFA was almost entirely an organisation that was dominated by European self-interest. Obviously, South American was a significant constituency of FIFA, and in fact, the South American nations had formed themselves into a confederation in 1916. But politically, the European members of FIFA really held sway, and effectively, they saw FIFA as a private club. They wanted the majority of the benefits that came from membership of that club. Things like the majority of World Cup places. They wanted to hold the most influential positions within the administrative structure of the game. So African nations grew increasingly frustrated during the 1960s because they felt that their aspirations for exposure on the international stage via football were being suffocated really by European self-interest.
And in 1966, the African nations boycotted the World Cup, right, over this very issue of access to the finals tournament.
Indeed they did, and probably the key figure in terms of that boycott plan was Kwame Nkrumah. And I mean, almost as soon as Nkrumah came to power, he saw football as a valuable tool in terms of the broader nation-building project. And he invested a lot of time and a lot of his own personal reputation in the success or otherwise of the Ghanaian national team. But of course, he wanted Ghana to achieve a degree of success on the international stage. But at that time, in order for an African nation to qualify for the World Cup, they had to play a playoff game against the winners of the Asian qualification group. So, and that was just for a single place. So realistically, opportunities for participation in the World Cup were quite minimal. So Nkrumah hatched this plan in 1964 to boycott the qualification stages of the 1966 World Cup. FIFA responded in a typically Eurocentric fashion. They fined the boycotting nations, which presented financial difficulties for these national federations. But ultimately, the boycott plan was effective because shortly after the 1966 tournament was held, a decision was taken within FIFA to grant Africa an automatic qualifying berth for the World Cup. But of course, in a tournament that had 16 nations, you know, you have a continent of
more than 50 states.
Yeah, absolutely, right. That are fighting over one World Cup place. The Confederation of African Football continued to agitate to have its allocation of World Cup places increased, and that campaign continues to the current day. I mean, Africa currently has five qualification berths, but there are aspirations for a more equitable distribution of World Cup places around FIFA.
Do you see this current struggle to gain more automatic berths in the finals as something that's going to be successful? Do you see those numbers increasing in the near future? There are 32 teams that qualify, for those who don't know. And so Africa has five guaranteed spots out of those 32. Is that number going to increase, you think?
I think it's going to be very much dependent on success or otherwise in the tournament itself. I mean, the Confederation of African Football was successful in securing those five berths for the 1998 tournament. And really, with those additional berths, I mean, some of the African nations didn't really do themselves justice in the tournament for a whole host of reasons. So that didn't justify further allocation of World Cup berths. Although we all have hopes, of course, that at least one of the African qualifiers and the hosts, of course, will do well at the 2010 World Cup. And I think if they can progress to the latter stages, maybe a quarter final or even a semi final, then that'll add a lot of weight to the argument for an increase in the number of births.
The problem, of course, would be how do you increase Africa's presence at the World Cup without taking away spots from, say, Europe, which continues to hold the largest number of spots in the finals. The other issue you mentioned earlier and that you talk about in the book is administration. And so what happens in terms of the presence of African administrators within FIFA? How do they gain power within the organization over time?
Well, I mean, it has been a slow process, a struggle. I mean, even for Africa to get continental confederation status in the first place, and way back in 1957, was a struggle. There was a feeling when this notion of having an African confederation was first mooted, there was a feeling within FIFA that African football wasn't sufficiently organised to merit its own confederation. So I think the confederation forming in 1957 was a crucial point in terms of Africa having a greater say within FIFA's corridors of power, not least because now they were relatively unified. You know, they could meet prior to FIFA Congress, have discussions about proposing particular motions. And alongside that process, gradually what happened was increasing numbers of African administrators were able to get positions within the context of FIFA's committee structure. And that process is still ongoing, and African football administrators continue to seek opportunities to join FIFA's committee structure to ensure that the world body operates in a way that also reflects the interests of Africa.
And has that translated into benefits for African football on the ground?
I mean, in terms of FIFA policy benefiting African football on the ground, probably the most significant issue has been the fact that as far back as 1974, those who had aspirations to become FIFA president recognised that Africa was an incredibly significant political constituency. I mean, FIFA's franchise arrangements operate on the basis of one nation, one vote. So if an individual had aspirations to become FIFA president, he had to secure the support of the African constituency. And in 1974, the Brazilian self-made businessman was able to really secure the African vote by making a lot of promises in terms of the increase of places for the World Cup finals, financial investment, construction of stadia, cash subsidies. So really from 1974 onwards, I mean, Havelange was obviously in power until 1998, but he always made sure that he was looking after the African constituency. And alongside that, you had a range of influential African administrators within FIFA who continued to agitate within the context of FIFA to ensure that FIFA operated as an organisation that was interested in the game across the world, not only in particular regions, not just in Europe.
Right, and then here we're thinking of, for example, Nkechi Dasema of Ethiopia,
of
more recently Issa Hayatou, who also ran against Blatter in the last presidential elections of FIFA and lost. That was quite an interesting election. Do you think there will be an African president of FIFA in the foreseeable future?
I think it's possible. I mean, the election where Issa Hayatou challenged Sepp Blatter was very interesting. Just incredibly political, as these elections for what, you know, are sports administrative posts ultimately invariably are. And the argument that I have posed about that particular election was that Hayatou was effectively used by UEFA almost as a stooge to attempt to win back the presidency from Sepp Blatter, because Sepp Blatter and his predecessor, João Havelange, had ultimately attempted to democratize the game. And of course, as part of that democratization, that challenged UEFA's status within the context of
UEFA
of the World
is
game.
The European Football sure. Confederation.
Sure. Yeah. So UEFA felt that the policies of Havelange and subsequently Sepp Blatter were actually detrimental to the European game. So they sought ways of attempting to wrest back control of the World game. And of course, the key position is the FIFA presidency. And in 1998, Lennart Johansson, UEFA's Swedish president, challenged for the FIFA presidency. And he was very perturbed by the process of politicking. He wasn't a particularly shrewd politician, didn't really enjoy the process. He lost the election and he made a decision that he would never again stand for the FIFA presidency. Now, this created a difficulty for the European Confederation because they still had aspirations to secure the FIFA presidency.
Right.
But to do so, they would have had to remove Lennart Johansson from the presidency of UEFA. They were reluctant to do that. But Lennart Johansson had a very close relationship with Issa Hayatou. And Hayatou was ultimately convinced by UEFA to put himself forward against Blatter for the FIFA presidency. And ultimately, Issa Hayatou was unable to secure unified support across the African nation, or the African continent rather. And Blatter was able to accrue considerable support within Africa on the back of his previous professed commitment to the African game. And he won the election by a landslide.
So we'll have to wait a long time,
yeah,
probably, to see an African president of FIFA, but perhaps it will happen. After all, South Africa is going to be hosting the 2010 World Cup, and this is a very important moment in the history of African football. So perhaps that presidency is not too far down the road. Now, more recently, you've been working on a very interesting project that extends the work you've just been talking about. You went to Ghana last year, and also just about a month ago.
Sure.
And what are you working on in Ghana? What's attracting your attention these days in the football of this very important African country?
Well, after the publication of my book, my first book, on the politics of Africa's place in the politics of FIFA. As part of the book, I started to get interested in the process of the migration of African players to the European continent and some of the processes that occurred around that. So I began to write from afar about this issue and posed, I suppose, some quite simplistic arguments and tentative theoretical positions. And I thought that I needed to test some of my hypotheses on the ground. So I was able to secure some funding from the Economic and Social Research Council. It's always good, of course, to mention the sponsors here.
Absolutely.
So I got some funding for a three-year project, really, that examines the migration of Ghanaian football players to Europe and further afield. But part of the project is also a collaborative venture with Professor Alan Klein, who's based at Northeastern University in Boston. And he, of course, has spent much of his academic career writing about the transit of Dominican baseball players to the United States, to MLB franchises. And specifically, he's examined the role of baseball academies in that process. So there is a comparative element to the project. I'm looking specifically at football labour migration. Alan is interested, as I say, in baseball labour migration, but we're also going to do some comparative analysis. And I think really that the sports of baseball and football within Ghana and the Dominican Republic respectively are ideal for comparative study for a number of reasons. For example, there has obviously been a long-standing tradition of talent extraction from the Dominican Republic into Major League Baseball, and there has been a long-standing academy system as part of that process. Likewise, in terms of the transit of football players from Ghana, although this process was really kick-started in the 1990s, it has increased exponentially in recent years. And increasingly, academies are coming to play a crucial role in that process. So we felt that there were useful opportunities to do good empirical comparative analyses. And we've also drawn in the past on similar theoretical positions in order to explain aspects of sports labour migration. So, as I say, it's a 3-year project. I'm about 1 year into it. Some quite tentative preliminary findings are beginning to emerge, which will be firmed up with subsequent fieldwork in Ghana and also in the Dominican Republic. And I've also included in the project a number of trips to the headquarters of the Confederation of African Football and also to FIFA as well.
Right. Critics of the migration of African footballers to Europe have sometimes equated it to modern-day slave trade. Mm. Is that your conclusion, given the amount of time you've already spent on this study and all your publications on labour migration? Is that a reasonable comparison?
I think it's an overly simplistic approach to what is quite a complex process, and every time I visit Ghana, there's an additional layer of complexity that I struggle to understand and to get to grips with. But really, in terms of answering that question, I think it's important to consider the nuances, the grey areas in the trade in Ghanaian players. As I said earlier, most Ghanaian players really exit Ghana via an academy. And when we think of a football academy within the African context, it tends to conjure some unsavoury images. We view them as plantations where ruthless businessmen will exploit the aspirations of young boys. And certainly some of the experiences that I had in Ghana resonated with that particular depiction. But there are layers, there are different types of academies that exist, some of which approach the process in a very professional way and also in a quite socially responsible manner. Just one quick example is an academy that was established by an English guy called Tom Vernon in 1999. And he found himself in Ghana as a 22-23-year-old with an interest in football coaching, got involved in some of the youth teams and gradually progressed to coach one of the local Premier League teams. And he became very disaffected with the kind of what he saw as the administrative malaise within Ghanaian football. So he decided to go his own route and start his own football academy. And initially, the academy was predominantly focused around creating opportunities for young boys to play elsewhere outside of Ghana, so to try and present opportunities. But of course, the academy was run predominantly as a business. Obviously, he wanted to make money from these endeavours.
Right.
But gradually, the more time he spent working with some of the young talent in Ghana, he began to develop a close affinity and affection for a lot of the boys, and he wanted to do something else for them beyond football, because he recognised that, you know, opportunities for securing a contract with a European club, you know, were very, very limited. And he began to ask questions about, well, what happens to the guys who don't make it? So he began to expand the philosophy of the academy to incorporate education, to incorporate an aspiration to empower young African boys, to give them the skills that would allow them to make decisions about where they saw their futures. Mm-hmm. And the academy has been very successful in that regard. I mean, I spent about a week at the academy, and the more time I spent around the academy staff and around the boys, it seems to me that this academy is underpinned by a very strong sense of social responsibility. And that's manifested perhaps most clearly in terms of the exit statistics for the first cohort of students who have come through the academy. Of the 15 students, two have signed professional contracts, both with Fulham in the English Premiership, but they've subsequently gone on loan to a Belgian club. Six others, though, have gone on to full educational scholarships in prep schools in the UK and in the US. And one of the boys has a full college scholarship to UCSB in the States. So these are guys who, I suppose, when they first came into the academy set up, they had aspirations to become the next Michael Essien and Didier Drogba, Asamoah Gyan, John Pansel. But gradually, the more time they spent in the academy, they were exposed to the education that they were provided, and they were really empowered by this experience and began to make decisions about where they saw their futures. And, you know, of the first cohort, six of these guys see their future in terms of achieving a good education.
So this is a very interesting case, and there are, as you pointed out, many other types of academies, of course, on the African continent. So we have to be careful how we generalize about this process. I mean, there's certainly evidence to show that Europe is extracting resources and cheap labor from Africa, but at the same time, there are opportunities for social mobility and economic empowerment in places. And what's interesting about your work, of course, is that you're showing that, again, football is an entry point. It becomes a career for some, but it also becomes a tool to do other things, like, for example, gain access to higher education overseas. The big challenge, I think, is how do you develop the game locally? How do the academies relate to the football movement within the single African countries? And that's really a complicated issue, and hopefully one that can be worked out for the benefit of the local players and the local fans and the local clubs, because so much of African football now is really looking outward. Whether it's the youngsters trying to secure the million-pound salaries in the Premiership, or watching European football in a tavern.
Of course,
right? There's all this attention to what's happening outside rather than a focus on local development. So,
of course.
So these are really interesting processes that you're uncovering. And I think it's also great that you're working with Alan Klein and looking at how Africa fits into the larger global structures of sport. Because so often Africa is treated as the problem continent in the world, right? Why isn't it achieving these levels of development, you know, and why are African countries not politically stable and prosperous and so on? These are the kinds of questions that Africa scholars and journalists are often talking about, but what you're saying is that you know, this needs to be put in a wider context. And that Africans have agency, right?
Of course.
And that agency plays out in so many different ways.
Absolutely.
So it's wonderful.
The other interesting element of the process of Ghanaian players leaving the country to go and play outside is the extent, I mean, directly related to the issue that you're making about local agency, is the fact that Ghanaians have inserted themselves into this commodity chain, very often at the lower levels, but also very often at the kind of at the higher levels as well. And one particularly stark example of Africans inserting themselves into this commodity chain and perhaps benefiting individually from that process would be the case of a club called Liberty Professionals, which began life in 1996, quite recently, was established by Alhaji Sly Teta, who was a former player. He played for Hazakas in the late 80s, early 1990s, went to study in the United States at Liberty University, I think in Virginia, if I'm not mistaken. When he came back, he began to represent a few players who had aspirations to move outside. And he thought, well, rather than be a representative, why don't I just start my own club? And he did that. And he sees the club predominantly as a business venture, as a medium for moving young players to the European continent, to the European game. Now, in some senses, that can be viewed as an extractive process, as something that undermines the local game. But he also has an aspiration to reinvest some of the finances that he recoups from the transfer of players back into the local game. Mm-hmm. For example, he's recently purchased a large plot of land, and he plans to build a 20,000-seater stadium for the team to become a powerhouse, not only within Ghanaian football, but also across the African continent. And his ultimate ambition is to have a strong club in Ghana that's competing regularly for the African Champions League, is moving some of their most talented players on to Europe, but reinvesting that money back into the local game.
And I think that's all the time we have for today's conversation. Paul, it's been great talking to you about African football. I think you have raised the bar for all scholars who work on the topic. It's not just about the scores and the statistics and the latest human interest story, of which there are many, right? It's also, there's also a great need to engage with sport in serious scholarly fashion. So hopefully there will be researchers out there and members of the media and sports administrators and so on who will take this charge and go forward and deepen our knowledge about African football. So thanks so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Africa Past and Present is produced by Matrix, the Center for Humane Arts, Letters, and Social Sciences online at Michigan State University. Our producer is Scott Pennington. Technical assistance is provided by Chris Johnson, Ryan Blyton, and Alicia Scheel. For more information about this show and to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit our website at Afripod, that's afripod.aodl.org. If you have any comments or suggestions for future shows, please send us a message at africa.podcast@matrix.msu.edu. Thanks for listening.